You're a dangerous guy, right?
I could be considered dangerous, yes.
You actually told Dr. Yotanis about a month ago that the people in the jail have no idea how dangerous you are.
No, they don't.
Is that one of those times when you did that smile? Is that one of those times when you can kind of fake your body language? You told the truth
No.
today.
No, I smile because it's funny that all the people in there have no idea who they're messing with.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi, guys. Thank you so much for joining me. And today's case is one of those that genuinely has sent chills down my spine. Goes without saying that every single case that I cover is heinous. And we talk about child death. We talk about the brutality of loss of life at the hands of people who we're going to be able to trust. Of course, it goes without saying that every single case that I cover is heinous, even for people who survive some of the horrendous attacks they endure. The reality is victims are always in positions that they shouldn't have to be in at the hands of people who should not feel that they have any right to do the things they do to them. But the reason this case really provokes something within me is because each and every one of us have got a myth of security. Of course we've got a myth of security. We couldn't live with the anxiety of thinking about worst case scenarios every single day of the week. Don't get me wrong, some of you will suffer with generalized anxiety disorder or extremes on the OCD spectrum. And actually you will feel like you regularly think about the worst case scenario. But for the people out there who are listening to this, who basically feel okay on the level of not suffering from things like anxiety and depression, then chances are you're not putting too much thought into eating your toast every morning when you have your breakfast. You're not thinking, I might choke to death today on this. You can do that, that happens. When you go to bed at night, you're not thinking, well, six people die falling out of bed every year. Maybe I'll be one of those unlucky people. Because it would just mean that you were walking around wretched constantly. And that is why, for the most part, and again, for the most part, because I appreciate that those of us locking our doors at night sometimes are locking ourselves in with the predators in our lives. But for those of us who genuinely do close our door when we get in from work or on an evening and feel that sense of serenity, that sanctuary, we genuinely believe that there is a safety in where we spend our private lives behind closed doors. And that's what really upsets me about this case, because even though it's a myth, and I get it, think about Richard Ramirez, think about the Hollywood Ripper, think about a whole heap of cases where you were at home and somebody broke in and did the most horrendous things to you or to the victims that I've covered in these cases. It does happen, I get it, but we like to believe it doesn't. So when I cover a case where it's been breached and the home that was once meant to be the sanctuary becomes essentially the resting place of your final moments on this earth because people felt that they had a right to break in and harm you, it just affects you in a different way because you can absolutely identify that that therefore could happen to you. Because what happened to Kim Cates is something that absolutely, taking that example that I've just given, could happen to each and every one of us. So it hits in a different way, it lands in a different way when we cover cases like this. Let's talk about this case, and I promise you it is one of those that will make you shake your head several times because it doesn't make sense. It's one of those things where you think, wow, the randomness, the fact that it could have been any of us, that's what I think provokes the intensity and the reaction I had when I was researching this. So this starts in 2004, and this affects an amazing family, a gorgeous family, Kim and David Cates. It also affects their young daughter, Jamie. And again, one of the things that really plays out for me here is you've got this couple who are really happy and really healthy and really thinking about what's right for their future, making a decision to move to a new place to give their child the best possible life, only for this dream to end in what can only be described as the most brutal of ways. So let's talk about the family. So Kimberly Cates, known as Kim, she was born on the 6th of March, 1967. She was born in Toledo, Ohio, and she was actually Kim Pazeski. Her parents were Lynette and James, and she had two brothers, Jeff and Scott, and they were a close family. She attended Pima community college in Arizona, and that's where she trained to be a nurse because she was highly vocational. She is an altogether good human being, compassionate to the core, and she chose a field where she could exercise those natural gifts and traits that she had. She then actually began working at Tucson Medical Center. Her family described her as a delightful human being. She was obviously compassionate and caring. We can see that from the vocation that she chooses as a job, but also her family said that was the same from day one. She was just built that way. They actually described nursing as her true calling in life. And I have to say, people who go into nursing because they are genuinely vocational and care deeply about their patients, I have such a profound respect for them. They're not paid an enormous amount of money. They literally have to deal with stress levels that very few of us could cope with. And there's a liability aspect these days that I genuinely don't think equates to what they get paid and the expectancies that are within the world, because I genuinely think that there is a hell of a lot involved in nursing. And when you take a job, you're not just taking the job to get paid, you're taking the job essentially to do a whole heap of things, including save lives. And that's challenging, but that also demonstrates exactly the kind of person that Kim is. Now, in 1997, she has a really happy event. She marries David Cates, and they are genuinely in love. They are a couple who are devoted to one another, and they have this really happy event the following year. They have a daughter in 1998, and they name her Jamie Lynn. David said, if he was going to describe his relationship with Kim, he had found his absolute soulmate. He said that she was literally somebody who was just absolutely full of energy, of excitement, of love, and she was a reflection of who he was within the relationship. And reading those words when I've been researching this case really stand out, because I think to love and lose is one of the most profoundly challenging experiences for each and every one of us. And for the most part, when we're in relationships, we want to truly believe that we've met our soulmate. But I think many of us, in fact, 50% of us, according to divorce statistics, know that that isn't easy to actually achieve. And relationships have worth when they only last for a few years, as long as they've been good times. But it's kind of hard, isn't it, to meet somebody, truly connect on that profound level and move forward, creating a family and feeling that absolute depth of connection. And he and her have it. Now, the family do live in Baltimore for a while, but in 2004, they decide to make a move. They go to Mount Vernon in New Hampshire. And the reason they do that is, firstly, they're going to get a bit more of a rural experience. They get to move into this really beautiful house. It's down a country road, and it is in a remote location, but it's just surrounded by trees. And I think for most of us, when you get to a certain age, I am showing my age. I promise you there's going to be a 16-year-old watching this now shaking their head. And I would have done the same. 16. I would have been like, sorry, what are you talking about? What are you talking about, trees? I want the city. I want pubs. I want nightclubs. I want lots of people that I can feel attracted to. I want excitement. And I also don't want to have to walk far to go to a shop to get a can of Diet Coke. You know, that's the kind of way I thought back in 16 years old. But the truth is, as you get older, particularly when you've had kids, all of a sudden, those bright city lights, they get replaced with the idea of just trees and fields and no noise. I think it's just to do with age. Your brain just shifts and changes, doesn't it? But arguably, they're at that point where they're thinking to themselves, we can create a beautiful future for our child in a safe place where arguably we can create a family unit, probably a growing family unit, and also exercise that idea that we are truly safe. And it's a big change because they had literally had a pretty big city lifestyle before this. And they loved the new home. They loved the new lifestyle. One of the slight downsides was that David had to travel a lot for work. So as a precaution, they went ahead and put an alarm system into their home just for peace of mind. They felt entirely safe where they were living. Now, unfortunately, that alarm system actually stopped working and they couldn't fix it. And I think that a lot of people relate to that. For example, I have an alarm system and mine doesn't work. I have other measures in my home, but the point is, it's pretty difficult understanding these things, and even getting people out to actually fix the problem is easier said than done because they get outdated and so on and so forth. But for the most part, when things go wrong in our homes, even if it's an alarm system, how many of us are immediately thinking, right, I need to get this fixed instantly because something terrible is going to happen otherwise? It's just not the way that we work. We always feel that we have a level of time. In fact, that's the thing psychologically about most human beings. It's the thing that causes us regret with respect. We often believe, well, I can do it tomorrow. And of course, tomorrow often never comes, or indeed comes too late. Now, Kim has the little girl, Jamie. They have a really close relationship together. They spend a hell of a lot of time together. They go shopping. In fact, one of the things that she spends a lot of time doing with her daughter is she goes to the karate studio because Jamie is excellent and she loves doing this as a hobby and it keeps her fit. And it also obviously is going to teach her some self-defense lessons. They actually were so close that they would sleep in the same bed when David was away for work. Certainly, I completely relate to that. I'm sure many of you do. If you're by yourselves in the house, particularly two females, I think there just feels that level of safety when you're sharing that space. And also it's a lovely intimate space for mother and daughter. And I think a lot of people in this day and age recognize the benefits of actually sleeping in the same bed of close family members. In fact, we can see spikes in serotonin and also oxytocin when you are sleeping in the same bed as a loved one. It's why in other cultures, actually a lot of people do share beds, numerous children and parents. It isn't a bad thing. It certainly has a lot of psychological benefits. And so they do that. And bear in mind, when they moved to that property, Jamie was six. So those 5 years that they're peacefully living there, that co-bed sharing, I think, will have formed a real bond between them. Now, sadly, unbeknownst to the Cates family, when they moved to that area 5 years earlier, what they didn't know that growing up around them were a group of miscreants, so youths or yobs in this case. They consisted of Stephen Spader, he was 17 at the time, Christopher Gribble, he was 19, William Marks, he was 18, and also Quinn Glover, who was 17. They basically lived relatively nearby in Brookline and Amherst. So bear in mind, they'd never even met them before, but those boys are literally going to change their lives forever. In fact, they're going to end a life forever. Let's talk about these individuals. So Stephen Spader, he was an individual who had a difficult start, it goes without saying. So when he was born, he tested positive for marijuana and cocaine. So that is absolutely not ideal whatsoever. You do not want a developing fetus to be exposed to things like marijuana and cocaine. And it's also indicative of the mother in this case, who was choosing drugs above the safety of a child. So she was somebody who did not have her priorities correct. And if she's taking weed and coke during a pregnancy, I do not imagine that she's going around really considering whether her diet's appropriate or maybe thinking smoking's bad for you. I would say that the priority for this child will have been incredibly low on her list, and he was probably exposed to a lot of other very unhealthy things. So he has a really troubling start to life. And it goes without saying, lots of children have troubling starts to life, and it does not mean they're going to become some kind of heinous excuse for a human doing awful things. But fractures in your foundations are important to note because, of course, they can be exacerbated and amplified as you go through life by some of your experiences and some of the things that you might do to your own body as well. Now, in spite of this, he actually gets a really lucky second chance. He's adopted by Christine and Stephen Spader at 5 days old, which is amazing because adopted children often go through quite a lengthy process before they finally get adopted. Now, in the UK, there is concurrent adoption now, which means that you can foster and then adopt if you're lucky enough to go down that path where the parent doesn't want the child back. And that can mean that you can have a child from pretty much day dot. But not everybody elects for that because the idea of falling in love with a newborn baby, particularly if you've been struggling to have children and suddenly you get the opportunity to adopt the child and then you risk the chance of potentially bonding incredibly with it and then 18 months losing custody of that child, that could be something that would be very problematic for many people psychologically. So still some people will elect not to do that, so they'll end up with a child at 18 months, for example. Now, even though that child will have had an amazing foster parent and placement, it's going to cause some fractures because you get this positive attachment level and then of course you have to reattach to new parents that you are going to be with long term. That's not the case here. There are not going to be attachment issues because at 5 days of age, Christine and Stephen give this child a brand new start, and boy, he landed on his feet. They gave him an absolutely wonderful home, and he did well. He was doing well in school. He actually took part in extracurricular activities. This included drama. He was performing in plays. But His behavior takes what could be described as an absolute nosedive when he goes to high school. And a lot of us can relate to that personally, and certainly with our own children. Going through school as a young person up until the age of 11 tends to be relatively okay. School is not the most pressured place. A lot of it's about peer experience and play. And even though you've got to do your work, you're not thinking, oh my God, it's going to be the end of my world if I fail this exam. And then you get to high school, and for a lot of us, the rug is pulled from under our feet and everything goes downhill. So we can contextualize the fact that many bright children get to their high school experience and start to fail, because it's not always the most welcoming or enjoyable of experiences and environments. Now, Christine, his mother, she said there was just this wonderful boy who was our son, who around the age of 16 switched overnight to someone else that was not controllable and had major, major issues. And of course, 16 years of age psychologically is a challenging age for any young person. You are trying to be a grown-up, but you're not a grown-up. You're trying to be taken seriously, but it's pretty hard for people to take you seriously because you're still a very young person. You've got certain new opportunities because parents tend to get a bit more flexible with you at that point, but you can also exceed those flexibilities and push boundaries to a point where it's not good for you, such as getting involved in drugs and all the things that go with that age frame, along with peer relationships, trying to stand out as an individual, figuring out who you are. So there's a lot of interplay psychologically, emotionally, socially, educationally at that point. So again, it's contextual. A lot of kids can certainly switch very quickly and go down a path that parents would not wish them to do. And he really did start to have some major, major issues. So he starts smoking marijuana, and he also starts to boast about being in a gang. Now, I know, as I say, every time I cover marijuana, that people will throw things at the screen if I suggest that everybody who smokes weed loses their mind. Of course, that's not the case. Of course, many people can smoke weed very regularly and it doesn't really impact on them. People get it prescribed in certain places in America for particular ailments like migraine and sleeplessness. I get it. But what I'm saying is, if you have fractures in your foundations, your brain is developing all the way until 25 years of age. Physiologically, what you put in your body has an impact. Add to that the fractures that already existed at his very beginning and the potential genetic predisposition of problems with his birth mother being involved in that, then understandably, him having weed could be very problematic on a range of levels. And also, boasting about being in a gang. When you are 16 years of age, you want to stand out, and yet you want to belong. You want to have a reputation. You want people to like you. If people don't like you, maybe you want them to fear you. You want something. You want to be notable. You want to be visible. And very few people, even those who are incredibly introspective, who feel that they are introverts, they still want to stand out to some degree, because otherwise it feels like life is a monolithic experience, because you can't check out who you are and what you're doing unless people are reflecting where you are and what you're doing. It's a two-way street, that experience. So wanting to be in a gang often speaks of somebody feeling like they don't necessarily connect and they want to connect. And by creating some kind of gang or group, they feel that they have a space where everybody within that space has commonalities, common features, common values, and a desire to pursue a particular road with one another. And that can certainly help with things like loneliness or depression, because suddenly you feel like you have meaning. But this could also speak of somebody with pretty antisocial beliefs, because he's smoking weed, he's acting out, he's not being very nice to his parents, and he wants to be in a gang. And most of us associate the word gang with negative connotations, and for good reasons. When we say, oh, he's in a gang, we're not thinking about the Scouts. We're not thinking about, well, he's been very into crochet. He and his gang have created a very, very beautiful rug together. That's not what we think. If my friend came over and was like, I'm really worried about Donovan. Why? Donovan's in a gang. I'd be like, we should worry about Donovan. Donovan should not be in a gang, because gangs are about knives and things. That's how we conceive gangs to be. It's very different from saying, I have a group of friends. There is not an indication of criminality, for example, when you say that. But gangs tend to have those undertones. And also, he's relatively violent with his parents. In fact, one incident, he actually threatens his dad with a knife, which is high level very high level. We have all had incidents as young people, as some of us will have had children where we have incidents with them. But if a child picks up a knife and threatens you with it, that is a whole different ball game. It really is. You're talking about a criminal offence and one that shows a high level malevolence in their actions. Also, there was another event where he was stabbing the kitchen counters. The police actually had to be called. So again, he's not physically attacking his parents, but he's showing potential. Because it's the kitchen counters that day at that level of anger. It's a threat with a knife at that level of anger. But where can that go? Because there are always tipping points in behaviours. And sometimes those tipping points tip over to brutality and sometimes fatality. Now, his parents do everything right. When we're talking about adoptive parents, these are literally the people that should be in the manual. Because they do not sleep on their laurels. They do not think to themselves, oh, he's going to grow out of it. They're like, we need to take some action. So they actually took him to psychiatrists to see, can you help? Can you figure this out? What's going on with our boy? And his first appointment began in 2006. They actually obtained at this point an individualized education plan for him at school. They actually borrowed money to send him to this really expensive residential treatment program. They did everything they could to just try to help figure out what their son needed and also how they could contribute to make his life better and also those around him's life better. But literally nothing they do seems to lead to any improvement. And that again brings us into this idea of, well, is there something personality orientated that means no matter what they do, he won't improve? Because if you think about antisocial personality disorder, you bet your bottom dollar, you can send them wherever you want. They ain't going to be getting the best out of it. They're going to be figuring out how to manipulate situations. They're going to be looking at how to intimidate other peers. They're not going to operate in a healing way because they have a personality that does not work in line with healing. It's juxtaposed to that because they are hardwired in a very different way. So without a doubt, at this point, we can say that Spader's life started in a rocky way, but then became something that could have been beautiful. But for whatever reason, no matter what his parents did or were doing, no improvement occurred. And that means that they have big challenges with him because not even any incremental changes seem to be going in a good direction. Then there was Christopher Gribble. Now, people who knew Christopher Gribble said that Chris was really awkward. He was an individual who seemed to be nice enough, but that he had issues picking up on social and emotional cues. His dad said he was really intelligent. He was really eloquent when he spoke, but he didn't understand if someone didn't want to talk to you. So essentially, he could become invasive when people didn't want him involved. But that wasn't because he was trying to be challenging or difficult. He just didn't get it. He didn't understand when you didn't want him around. And that obviously can be challenging to watch as well, particularly if you're a parent, you're seeing a child try to engage and interact and it's not welcome and they don't get that message. And so they again continue and it doesn't work out well for them. Now, people described him as a dork. They said he really enjoyed playing Dungeons and Dragons. And I think that that fits in with that stereotype, doesn't it? But there are some super cool human beings who play Dungeons and Dragons. And also, I often think that the word dork is so misrepresented because I just think dork means super successful. I think what appears like a dork at school is the person who's running the company 15 years down the line. They tend to be super bright. Yes, they tend to be a little bit more introspective or introverted, but that certainly means that they tend to spend time with academic work effectively and they go on to succeed. And the fact that he plays Dungeons and Dragons means that he's obviously got an excellent attention span and he has keen interests. And I always think that you get sliding doors moments, don't you, in life? Because to all intents and purposes, potentially if this guy hadn't met Spader, we might not be talking about this story as we're going to today. Now, Spader and Gribble had known each other for a very long time. They'd met in the Scouts, so obviously in the pro-social years, shall we say. But they hadn't spoken for around 2 to 3 years, but they reconnect in 2009. And I guess this could be the beginnings of a folie à deux. Although there are more people involved, I do think principally there are two individuals who are the most dangerous in this. Then there's William Marks. Now, he had been in trouble. He'd been in trouble for chasing another car. He crashed into it. He was considered by people around him more of a misfit. So somebody who was a bit of an oddball. Apparently he was deeply insecure. His father, James, he described him as really young, really impressionable, and someone who was just likely to follow the crowd, somebody who wanted a leader. And he said that things started to really go wrong for his son when he started hanging around with the wrong crowd. Then there's Quinn Glover. He was described by people around him as being really withdrawn. He was somebody who had gone to church, and people who knew him from church said it was notable that he kept himself to himself but seemed to get more withdrawn as the years grew on. And I think that when we look at adolescence, one of the things that I remember learning many years ago in child and adolescent behaviour is that many young men, when they hit 13 years of age, seem to withdraw and disappear. I remember talking to a psychologist who was very advanced in their research around this, and they said, really, their reassurance to parents is by 19, your child will probably start to come out of themselves, and by 25, you'll have him back completely. So it is not atypical for teenage boys in particular to be withdrawn, but it was something that had stood out, and people who had known him as a child really recognised the difference. He apparently sang and played guitar at church functions, so he's obviously very talented, and he was actually a B student, and he also had no criminal record, so he's bright. It's really upsetting when you start describing who these kids are on paper, because it's clear they have a huge amount of potential. And yet here we are talking about a case where a murder has taken place, altering every single one of their lives unbelievably, and also ending and changing the life of others in such a dramatic and hideous way. Now we get to the September of 2009, and these four boys, they think to themselves, well, we want to create something unique for ourselves. We want to do something that makes us feel like we're this solid, connected group. So they start a brotherhood. And they referred to this as the Disciples of Destruction, or DOD for short. Now, as far as names for groups are concerned, Disciples of Destruction sounds a little on the malevolent and evil side. And people will say, well, some young people have got an air of the dramatic around them, but I genuinely think that if you're thinking about a name for a group, Disciples of Destruction is not one that makes me feel safe around your intentions. And they had this idea about why they were going to get together and what the group aims were, and that was basically to steal money. Now, Spader, of course, was the president of the group, and Spader felt that it was his job to make rules, and the rules he made he expected the members to follow. Also, they had to have goals that they wanted to strive towards. He was going to set these. It was their job then to all achieve those goals. If we were talking about this in a corporate setting, and there was this leader who was setting these goals and helping people strive towards their achievement, we'd be saying that they were doing a decent job, because actually you have to set goals if you want to achieve them. But it equally, if you're going to do this in an evil way, it means that by setting goals, you are more likely indeed to follow whatever those goals are, because they've been set in stone. And Spader really has this intent to make sure that they go through with them. Now, Spader made Marks and Glover officers in the Brotherhood, which is ludicrous, but again, speaks to him almost organising something that makes it seem like there is an enforcement level around it. If you have officers, then you have people above officers who are going to tell you what to do. So psychologically, it's quite an impactful thing to do, because it makes those young men believe that they have a role and they have to follow through on that role. Now, Gribble, they also became a member, but apparently at this point, Glover was unaware of this, so didn't know that Gribble was fully involved. Now, not content with breaking into homes, because they're doing that, they're stealing items, and they're obviously honing their skills in this area, Spader makes a decision that it's not enough, that he wants more from these break-ins. So he starts talking to the Brotherhood about his desire that he's got, a desire that has been festering within him and growing within him, and that is to murder the people inside the homes they're going to break into. And he's also thought about how they might do that. So he said he wanted to use chloroform on the residents of the home. Now, we all know that chloroform is something that is going to knock those people out. It's one of those things that we've seen in the past certain killers use to subdue their victims. So he essentially wants to subdue them using this chloroform. Then he's going to tie them up. Then he's going to torture them for their financial details. And then after he's got those financial details, he's going to have them killed. So this is a well thought out plan and also speaks of somebody who has been fantasizing for a long period of time. We get to October the 3rd, 2009. At this point, Spader speaks to his friend, somebody called Autumn Savoy. Now, Autumn Savoy had actually helped him design the logo for DOD, but wasn't actually a member himself. And he told Autumn Savoy that he was going to go and do a job that night. And that night, he was going to have a means of initiation for the members of his brotherhood. Now, Savoy, at that point, just thought he meant that this guy's hoping that the group are going to follow him in a robbery. So he just thinks Spader is going to go and steal from a home. Spader actually used Savoy's computer to search at this point how chloroform is made. And he says to Autumn Savoy, I need the chloroform for a robbery. So even though that is very extreme, and Autumn Savoy should have been running in the opposite direction or advising him, don't be ridiculous, this is a ludicrous thing to do. Bear in mind that this is an individual who is very confident, who's probably a bit scary and probably does not want to be challenged. And I imagine that if Savoy had said to Spade, you're being ludicrous, it might not have been a positive outcome for him. And also, I think there is almost an allure about Spader, and Savoy probably is in a little bit of awe of him, so doesn't say anything and has no idea of the true intention of what Spader wishes to do that night. Now, Gribble obviously is aware that Spader wants to create chloroform. So he actually tries to acquire some acetone. He asks his girlfriend and his girlfriend's mum, do you have any acetone? Because obviously it's something you can remove nail varnish with. He said, basically, I want to clean a knife. Personally, I'd have been like, why do you want to clean a knife? Well, I want to clean a knife. Why do you need acetone? Why do you use acetone to clean a knife? I mean, I know it gets rid of nail varnish, but I'm pretty sure some bitter things to clean a knife. I just want some, have you got any acetone? No, I'm just really suspicious of you now. What kind of knife have you got? Honestly, there'd be a list of literal questions about why he's cleaning a knife. But of course, we know the real reason that he wants the acetone is he's going to try to make chloroform, and chloroform requires acetone. Now, Spader told Marks, another one involved in this, that Gribble is indeed trying to make the chloroform and that he also apparently needed ice to do this. Now, unsurprisingly, because this group aren't the most sophisticated, they are unable to actually get the ingredients that are required to make the chloroform. But it doesn't mean they were not intentional, and it certainly doesn't mean they were not absolutely trying to do so. Now, we get to October the 4th, 2009. David Cates, he's just working away in Maryland. He's left his family. They're safe. They're thriving. He probably wasn't thinking that anything terrible could ever happen to them in the beautiful home they were living in and also in the family life that they were experiencing. But little does he know that destruction is literally going to befall his life. Ironically, by the self-titled Disciples of Destruction. Because sometime before 4 a.m, those youths, those young men, those disciples of destruction, they target the Cates household. They break in while Kim and Jamie slept peacefully beside one another in that shared bed. Now, this is how random the attack was. They'd actually initially, as a group, set their sights on a neighbouring home, but they'd suddenly decided on that same night it was too big. So instead, they look at the more manageable Kate's house. And you can understand their thinking, because the logic is if it's a bigger house, there might be more people. If there's more people, well, that might be a bigger problem to overpower. So this just demonstrates the level of randomness of this attack. Now, to gain entry to the home, initially they break a basement window and they lower Marks in through this. He's actually the only one who could fit. He's the smallest of the group. He was 5'3". He was 97 pounds. So he's light enough and small enough to go through it. The plan does not run smoothly. He's actually unable to open the door from the basement to the rest of the house. And he at that point believed that it was locked. So he's kind of stuck now in the basement. So the other three criminals, they've got to find a way in now. They've got one of them stuck there. They actually managed to do that by taking down an air conditioning unit by a window, and they managed to get in through the gap that it leaves behind. Now, at this point, ironically, they realised that the basement door hadn't actually been locked after all. It just needed pushing. At this point, ironically, they also realised that the basement door hadn't been locked after all. It had just been pushing a door that needed pulling. So they could have all got in without doing what they did. Now, once they're all inside the house and Marks is free from the basement, they then turn the power off to the house. which is just terrifying, isn't it? Because it means it's going to be dark, and it means that the victims in this case are not going to be able to see what's happening. They then use an iPod, which they found in a bedroom, and they use that as a light source. Now, Spader opens the door to the master bedroom. At this point, actually tells the others that there are people in there. However, that group of boys, they actually thought he said no one's in there. So at this point, they kind of think, well, there's no point whispering because no one's in there. They expected if anybody was home that they'd be in that room. So they start speaking louder, and understandably, it wakes Kim up. Now, Kim's coming out of that slumber. We've all been in that situation where we're kind of coming round from that dream state into reality, and we're not quite sure of what's going on, and we might have heard noises or voices. But our first understanding will be it'll be somebody in the house that we know. And indeed, for Kim, she says, "Jamie, is that you?" And she actually tries at this point to turn on the bedside lamp. But as we know, the power's been turned off, so no lights go on. At this point, Jamie awakes, but she awakes to the sound of her mother's blood-curdling screams because the brutal attack has begun. Spader, he's got a machete. He repeatedly used that to hack at his victims. Gribble's choice of weapon was a long knife. Kim, the absolute hero, a mother who would sacrifice everything, including her life, for a child, she actually tried to use her own body to shield her daughter. She's also attempting to comfort her daughter, saying that everything's going to be okay as she is being hacked to death. Just imagine her bravery. Imagine the overriding feeling of being a mother, needing to protect and comfort your child over your pain. That's what we're demonstrating here. A mother who's being brutalized and murdered, and yet all she is thinking about is her daughter and trying to soothe her daughter. I can only hold her in an esteem that is so high, it's almost impossible to describe. Now, bear in mind, Jamie is absolutely terrified. She knows her mother's been seriously injured. She knows she's getting injured. She jumps up over her mum, and she actually almost ends up in Gribble's arms. And Gribble, for that, stabs her repeatedly in her face and in her chest. In fact, Gribble was trying to be very specific. He was aiming for her heart. He wanted to kill her. There was no doubt whatsoever. This is a child. He couldn't have cared less. All he wanted to do was go for the main areas of her body that would be fatal. He then throws her against the glass door. At this point, Kim's been slashed in the head, in the torso, in her arms, in her legs. She was making these gurgling noises because understandably she would be choking on her own blood and struggling to breathe, and her lungs are punctured. So Gribble then stabs her in the neck and chest. Spader then walks over to Jamie, this child, and he then kicks her. And then he hits her with the machete. Now, Glover and Marks, they didn't actually participate in the attack. In fact, Glover, it was too much for. He ran into the living room. He was covering his ears as soon as the actual onslaught of the attack starts. And Marks just stood by the bedroom door. So they were complicit. They're there, but they weren't engaged in the actual attack. Now, when they saw their friends come out of the bedroom, one of the things that Glover noticed was that the machete was just covered in blood and hair. Spader actually said to him that, quote, "We made enough noise because two people are dead." Just absolutely no connection to what had actually played out. Just an acknowledgement that there was a lot of noise, and there was a reason for that noise, because they'd brutally murdered, as far as he was concerned, two people. At this point, they leave the house, they steal some items, including some jewellery, but they made a huge oversight. Jamie wasn't dead. That 11-year-old little girl was still alive. That's despite these massive injuries, despite the fact that she has literally been brutalized and butchered in the most heinous of ways, and yet she is still clinging to life. And I have no idea how this warrior did what she did, but she knew that the only way that she may survive was to pretend that she was dead. And that's exactly what she did. She lay there and acted like she was dead to fool her assailants. Once those boys left, somehow, she managed to muster the strength to stagger to the phone in the kitchen, and she called the emergency services for help. This is an 11-year-old girl She's been brutalized in the most terrible of ways. She's got these horrific injuries. She's just watched her own mother be slaughtered in front of her own eyes. I cannot even begin to conceive of the horror, the terror, the fear. She must have been so scared. She must have been in so much pain. The grief must have been overwhelming. She's both physically and emotionally traumatized. But to have the strength, to have the presence of mind to do that, to actually lie still, to not cry, to not make any noise, and then to ring the police, that is nothing less than remarkable. At 4:15 a.m., Sergeant Kevin Furlong got that call to attend Fortrow Road. That was the home of the Cates. He arrives. At this point, you can see that the lights actually are on inside the house. And then he notices this young girl inside. She's on the floor. She's covered in blood. He breaks down the front door. He gets inside using his shoulder and he carries her outside. Jamie could barely speak, but she told him, "They killed my mummy." I can't even imagine what that officer must have felt. The fact that he carries her out as a father would carry a child. The fact that he knows that she's so brutalized, so injured, and he moves her from essentially the crime scene to take her from death into life, because that's essentially the action that happens in that moment. He could have left there till the emergency services arrive, as in the paramedics, but he doesn't. He chooses to be like a father, a paternal action, to carry this child from the death into the potential life. And Jamie was right. Her mother had been killed. Her mother had lost her life in that brutal attack. And when they actually did the autopsy, it was absolutely heinous when it came down to the results. She had 32 wounds on her body. This included defensive wounds to her arms. Her skull had literally been split open. Part of her brain was visible. Her left eye socket had been destroyed, and I mean destroyed. Her throat had been slit. Several of her organs had been struck by the blades, and also some of her bones were visible. She had been alive for every single wound that had been inflicted upon her. Everyone. And even though each of those wounds gravely injured her, not one of the blows had been immediately fatal, meaning that she suffered immensely until she finally bled out as a result of all her wounds. It was the cumulative bleeding out of those wounds that had actually been the cause of her death. And Jamie, the survivor in this case, her injuries were horrific. They were extensive. Her arm was broken, which indicates the level of force we're talking about where this attack is concerned. Her left foot had been severely injured. In fact, a part of it had been completely cut off. She'd been stabbed on two sides of her heart. For the grace of God, she survived because they were aiming for that heart. She had a wound above her hip that had literally almost penetrated her abdominal cavity. Also, she had this very deep laceration on her face. And her jaw had been fractured. She's 11 years of age. 11 years of age. David Cates, the father and husband in this case, literally got a phone call from the state troopers to tell him that his wife and child had been attacked. They told him that his wife was dead. They also encouraged him to come back as soon as possible because his daughter was gravely injured. And that's what he did. He rushed home. I can't even imagine the horror that he must have felt in that moment and the speed in which he made sure he came home, because to carry the weight of your loss and also the potential loss of your child, the immeasurable pain that must cause in that moment. I imagine that if you asked him to recount that journey home, he wouldn't be able to. He would have just been in a blur. And also, I would imagine that he would have broken every speed limit to get to his daughter. Of course, the group of young men, they're having a great time. They're thrilled with what they've done. They've carried out this heinous crime and they're proud. And they've got some kind of plan to how they're going to get away with it initially. So they take the clothes off, they put them in a bag, they clean the knives. Then they drive to a Walmart. This is where Spader leaves his car. Then they go and stay with Autumn Savoy. And they actually stayed there until morning. Now the next day, they go and throw the bag with the bloody clothes into a river. They attempt to sell the jewellery, which they'd stolen, at a cash for gold. They actually received $130 for that. They then try to dispose of the other evidence. So this includes David's wallet, a pearl necklace, and also the knives which they'd used in the attack. Now, of course, this kind of mild sophistication, as in trying to get rid of everything, trying to create alibis, getting rid of the clothes that are bloody. To some degree, that's organised. But what isn't organised is Spader and Gribble bobbing around, boasting to everyone about the attack. So literally, the least sophisticated thing that any murderer can do is be like, you know what I did last night? Well, let me tell you. That's clearly the most disorganised that you can be. But we have this couple of young men who are excited by their actions. They don't have a conscious link, I would say, in this moment to the reality of what they've done, and they can't help themselves. Suddenly, this is an opportunity to be visible, to be notorious, and it's too alluring, it's too exciting to control. So they go around telling people, and one of the young people that they told could not contain what they had heard, and they went straight to the mother, Carol Fenton. So once Carol Fenton has got this information, she thinks, well, this could just be young people making it up. But at the same time, my kid has described something that seems like it's very real. At least they feel it's real. That's why they're speaking to me about it. So she goes ahead and looks up online. And then she finds out to her horror that Kim's been murdered. And that this child of Kim's, Jamie, has also been horribly injured. And because her young person has described to her in detail what they've been told by these young men, she thinks they could be responsible. Based on the description of the murder, this could be the one that they've actually carried out in reality, not in fantasy. So it doesn't take the officers involved in this investigation very long. And on October the 5th, 2009, the teenagers are all arrested in connection with the home invasion. Now, when Gribble's interviewed, he initially does the classic, I don't know what you're on about, I'm not involved in any of this. He claims as well at this point, conveniently, that even though I definitely am not involved in this, I also don't remember anything at all in the last few days. So he goes for the fact that, first off, he's not involved, but secondly, even if he was involved, at the end of the day, he doesn't have any memory of it. A little bit on the convenient side. Now, the investigators, they play a classic detective ruse. They say that his friends have been giving stuff up and what he's basically telling them doesn't align with their accounts. They then say, this is your opportunity to explain why this happened. And also that because multiple people were involved, he needed to start thinking about himself. At this point, Gribble tells them he's innocent. He says, look, if you have any evidence against me, you'd have already arrested me. So he's obviously quite superior and arrogant in that moment. He feels as if they had this information, they wouldn't just be posing these questions or suggestions. They would actually be saying, look, we've got you banged to rights, we've got you dead to rights, so just acknowledge that this is the reality. Also, he went on to say that he didn't have anything to say and that he wouldn't say anything in the interview. So that's where he begins. However, about an hour after the interview with the officers ended, Gribble literally elects to call one of the investigators, Trooper Encanarco, back into the room. Then he just talks about the weather, he asks lots of questions, including things like, is your job hard? Is it hard to deal with? He asks this trooper what crimes he believes someone should be given the death penalty for. I bet the trooper's thinking, well, the one I'm investigating right now, actually. It's a good example of when I think people should be put to death. But after this kind of going around the houses, asking these questions that are all irrelevant, Gribble then says, you know what? Why don't you get a recorder? I'll tell you everything. And he does. He subsequently confessed to the crimes. And he actually takes the investigators to all the places where they had hidden the evidence. So he has really blown it all open for the others. There's nowhere to hide because Gribble has essentially told the officers what they need to know. Now, Spader, Marks and Glover obviously are not aware that Gribble has sung like a canary, essentially, at this point. And certainly at the beginning, they denied any involvement in the murder and in the attack on Jamie. They just tell the story that they'd gone to Walmart around 2 a.m. Then they'd just gone for a drive around Milford and Mount Vernon. And Glover actually created the scenario where he said that he had a panic attack. So he'd had to get out of the car to manage that. But understandably, the police have all the information that they know. So it doesn't take them long at all for Gribble and Spader to be charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, because of course it was all planned, witness tampering, and conspiracy to commit burglary, again, because it's all planned. Now, prior to the trial, Gribble actually did attempt to suppress his confession. He said, listen, my right to remain silent was violated because I told you I wanted to remain silent. And basically, I had that conversation with the trooper, but I hadn't done it in a situation where I thought I was being formally interrogated. So he said, essentially, I didn't have my rights invoked at that point. Now, the court were like, well, we could allow that to be heard and go forward and believe what you're saying. But instead, we're going to deny that motion. And rightfully so, he literally called the trooper into the room and then just spoke out about everything that he'd done after telling him to get his recorder. So it's determined that the defendant's statements were initiated solely by him without any prompting by the police, because there wasn't any prompting by the police. They also said that Trooper Encanaco's responses didn't actually amount to the functional equivalent of an interrogation, because, of course, the trooper wasn't leading it. The actual individual who was the defendant in this case was leading it. Now, Marks and Glover, they were actually charged with burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary and robbery. And one of the reasons Marks and Glover got to do this is they made plea deals, because essentially for the state, it was helpful to have two of the defendants cooperate and provide the testimony against Spader and Gribble, because Spader and Gribble had undoubtedly carried out the most heinous of these actions. And it's really nice to have two individuals who were actually present being witnesses against them. So that meant that those two would not be charged with first degree murder, but essentially because their testimony would mean that Spader and Gribble were going to get very stern sentences. Now, in November 2009, Autumn Savoy was also arrested because he had essentially helped the boys throw the blood-soaked clothes into the Nasho River. Also, he had provided the boys with a false alibi. He said that Spader and Gribble had spent the night at his house on the night that the attack had occurred. So he was certainly somebody who was lying to the officers and to the detectives. And if you think that we're talking about the murder of an innocent mother and almost the killing of a child, it takes a certain mindset to go ahead and try to help the individuals who've caused such an atrocity. And certainly, I believe that individuals like that should serve time in prison, a long time at times. We get to October 2010 when Spader's trial takes place. At this point, he pleaded not guilty. I have no idea how people like Spader ever think they're going to get away with it. Do you know what I think? I think people like Spader are classic egocentric narcissists, where all they think about is being center stage. They really don't care about the pain they cause individuals when they're going not guilty, meaning that everybody has to sit through an awful trial, even when they have caused the most immeasurable pain to the family already. I think that it's alluring for them, it's exciting for them, it's psychologically controlling for them to actually go ahead and do that. And clearly, he's going to get found guilty, but why not have some fun along the way? That's the antisocial mindset. Now, whilst he was incarcerated, one of the things that he'd actually done was written letters to another prison inmate, a guy called Chad Landry. They'd been passing them to one another in pages of books that they slid to each other. Now, in those letters, he'd literally written about the murders. Also, he'd written about the events leading up to it, including literally the creation of the Disciples of Destruction. In fact, a 10-page letter started with the line, "So begins the tale of the Mount Vernon murder by Stephen A. Spader." One of the letters read, "So Billy, Chris and Quinn knew that I've been about bodies and all three wanted to kill someone. Personally, I was considering starting a crew, not a gang, but a group of like-minded individuals with the balls to do crazy shit. I didn't want pussies or people who just talk the talk, dig. So I set this up to see if my homies could be about it. I guess I thought wrong." I mean, I always find it absolutely mind-blowing how so many killers feel the need to write what they did down. We've heard about it time and time again in cases that I've covered. Diaries, journals, literal descriptions of exactly what they were going to do, or in fact, what they did. It's as if the narcissism within them is so enormous that they have to translate it elsewhere. They can't help it. They have to speak about it, even if it's only to themselves, or in this case, to another fellow inmate. But understandably, Landry's like, hang on a minute. I've got an opportunity here to reduce my own sentence if I use these letters as leverage, which kind of makes sense. This guy that is sharing the letters with in prison, he's thinking to himself, this is an absolute confession. The officers in this case are going to want to give me some kind of options when it comes down to my own sentence if I hand them over. Now, one of the excerpts from a letter actually read, "I hacked at the mom. Death doesn't frighten me. Blood excites me. And in another, Spader wrote that he could literally see one of Kim's eyes hanging out of the socket, and that also he could see parts of her brain after he'd attacked her. Now, that description, of course, after I talked about it earlier within the autopsy report, aligns with the injuries that Kim sustained. He also wrote, "It was such an adrenaline rush. I almost hit Gribble with the machete. He said I look crazy." So he's really enjoying reliving it, and he has no shred of remorse. In what I've just described, there's no shred of remorse whatsoever. I just like to believe that the big G.O.D. is imprinting these kind of killers with that level of narcissism, as I've said, that just trips them up, and indeed it has tripped him up. Also, they got a handwriting analyst in to check that he had written the letters, and they said, absolutely, these were written by Spader. So essentially, guilt through his own hands in more ways than one. Now, Jeffrey Streslin, that was the prosecution, he said that the letters that Spader had written to Landry were absolutely sufficient evidence to prove every charge and essentially amounted to a confession. Now, a doctor who treated Jamie, the daughter in this case, they said that her injuries, more specifically her punctured lung, would have killed her if she'd been unable to alert the police before losing consciousness. So that child was so close to death. This should have been a double homicide to some degree. Even though she lives, you kind of think these guys wanted her dead, and you just want them given the strongest of sentences because of that. Now, when Glover testified, he said that the random attack had been loosely inspired by the Zodiac Killer. So Glover told Spader, this is prior to the murder, that Zodiac Killer had picked victims randomly, left the murder scenes really quickly, and also didn't leave evidence behind. And that's one of the reasons, without a doubt, that the Zodiac Killer got away with it. You don't leave evidence, you pick random people that aren't related to you, and you get out of the way really quickly, you have a lower chance of being caught. Now, he said that while Spader and Gribble were attacking the mother and daughter, one of the things that really stuck with him was that he could hear them begging for their lives, along with obviously terrified screams. He also heard Kim telling Jamie to run because Kim would have absolutely sacrificed her life for her child's. Jeffrey Streslin, the prosecutor, said that Spader was someone who made a conscious decision to go out and randomly attack and kill innocent people. 100%, that's exactly what he did. He also described the killer as being well-equipped to make rational, logical, and legal decisions, and he chose not to. So he's saying he's completely compos mentis, he's in his right mind, and he's still choosing to do the most malevolent of actions. He also said that Spader was not unintelligent, he was not abused, he had many of the luxuries in life that other people don't have. And he referred to Spader and Gribble, saying that they'd chosen their victims at random to make it less likely they would be caught. This prosecutor said they don't care about other people. And unfortunately, they took great satisfaction in inflicting pain and mayhem on innocent people. It gave them a sense of power and pleasure. That's who they are. I agree completely. I think we all agree completely with that prosecutor's belief system. We get to November 2010. Unsurprisingly, Spader was convicted. It was actually his 19th birthday. So happy birthday, Spader. Here's to all the rest of them in prison. Now, Judge Abramson, who I like a great deal in this case, because sometimes judges have a sense of sadness for the individuals that they convict, particularly young people, because they see that their lives could have been different and that they've chosen an altogether wrong path. But Judge Abramson doesn't feel that way. So Judge Abramson said that in this case, there were no mitigating circumstances, but she said the aggravating circumstances were, quote, exponential in number. And these included threatening behaviour towards witnesses during his trial. She also commented that he'd had to be admonished on 3 separate occasions in court due to his attitude. And he was sentenced, as we would expect, to life in prison without the opportunity for parole for first-degree murder. He was also given another 76 years for his other convictions, so he's never going to see the light of day freely. The judge also said that she could literally go on for days and days and days about the depths of his depravity. She said, "It's safe to say that you belong in a cage." And also that the sentence he'd been given would at least make sure that he will stay in the cage for the rest of his pointless life. I have a lot of alignment with this judge, genuinely, absolutely, for the rest of his pointless life. Then we get to February 2011, and Gribble, of course, can't just accept the consequences of his actions. He goes not guilty by reason of insanity. So at this point, they have to have a trial that takes place to determine whether his actions had been carried out due to him having a mental defect. So essentially, was he insane at the time of the murder? In his confessions to the state troopers, he had been able to describe eloquently why he'd got involved with the robberies. He said that he'd been doing the robberies, he'd been pawning stolen jewelry because he'd been desperate for money. He hadn't been able to find a job. So he was completely cogent in his understanding of why he'd done them. He also described what they'd done in Mount Vernon as a, quote, test to make sure that we had the balls to do whatever. He told the troopers on the night of the murder that they'd planned to rob a house and that if anyone was there, they were going to kill them. They were going to have some fun. And he explained exactly what happened that night. So he's not in a scenario where he's in mental decline. He also referred to Marks as, quote, retarded for not being able to open the basement door. So again, describing that he has a full and thorough understanding of the crime scene itself. He also said that when Kim woke up and tried to turn the light on, Spader had, quote, totally lost it and started hacking at her. But Gribble said that he had stabbed Kim 3 times and described how he attacked Jamie as she tried to flee. And literally, David, the parent in this case, the husband in this case, had to sit in court as that confession was played. Because, of course, this guy's gone not guilty. And yet there is this cogent, totally together confession, which doesn't sound like he's in any decline whatsoever, where he has been recorded telling them everything about what played out that evening, including his clear enjoyment of attacking Jamie, an 11-year-old child. So you can imagine that for David, Kate, in this, he's literally sitting there listening to the demise of his own family at the hands of this killer. And in court, he just shook his head occasionally. It must have been incredibly difficult for him to hear that account, especially in what I can only describe as a cavalier way that Gribble describes it. It's like he's just casually discussing the brutal murder of David's wife and the attempted murder of his daughter with no connection to any feeling whatsoever. Gribble is not affected emotionally. He speaks so matter-of-factly like it's nothing. So the idea of being out of his mind is ludicrous. And when Gribble takes a stand, he ends up talking about the abuse he had suffered at the hands of his mother as a child. I appreciate that people who abuse his children have a harder time in life because it absolutely affects your trust in the world and no child should ever suffer, that goes without saying. But I have covered abuse on this channel and I am going to throw in that when he is describing abuse, even that seems out of context with which our expectations would be around a description of childhood real abuse. Because he said things like this: she used to make him hoover the stairs at a young age. Well, bloody hell, I've been seriously abused by my own parents. Let me tell you guys, I used to have to hoover my house pretty much 3 or 4 times a week. Guess what I did once this actually happened? This is a ludicrous confession, but I'm just going to say it anyway. Judge me as you will. I was so bored of hoovering the house that I recorded the hoover and I used to put the hoover out and I used to play the recording of the hoover just sometimes so I could get away with not hoovering. My mum liked to have a really clean carpet. No one needs to hoover the house as often as my mum made us hoover the house. It wasn't abuse. It was just tidying. Also, apparently she used to hold him down and pop his acne pimples. So I'm screwed there as well because when my kids were suffering with spots, you bet your bottom dollar I'd be like, I'm just going to squeeze that. Also, another reason that he had said he was abused was he had to do housework and schoolwork instead of being able to go out with friends. So we're all abusers, every single one of us with a kid. Unless you are so liberal that your children have got no boundaries. Literally, we're all abusers. It's as simple as that. Apparently, she had smacked him in the head one time and his auntie had seen that. We agree, you shouldn't smack a child in the head. But I do genuinely feel that he's stretching in this idea of child abuse, particularly where physical abuse is concerned. He also told the court that his parents always believed the bad things they were told about him. So for example, on 2 separate occasions, 2 women had complained that he groped them. And he said, my dad, being my dad, is ready to believe anything bad of me. I've always had to prove myself innocent to him. You're in court for murder, an attempted murder. I'm imagining your parents were onto something. I'm imagining there was some kind of intuition that you were a wrong'un and they didn't like it. Also, he told the court that when he was around 14, he realised he wasn't normal as he wanted to kill his mum. He actually said he wanted to cut little pieces off her and listen to her scream. He also smiled frequently during his testimony. Now, he could be smiling because he was out of his mind. I agree that on an emotional level, we would not expect smiling to be contextual. And certainly if you are trying to look a little bit mad, maybe smiling may make you feel that that is going to convince the jury that that's the case. But equally, it can be duper's delight. Oh, I'm telling a story and I'm loving the fact that I believe I've got an audience. And as I'm telling this story, I can't help laughing and grinning because, hey, I'm pulling the wool over everyone's eyes. Think about Diane Downs. That's the murder I've covered. She's classic duper's delight. Now, when he actually talked about the murder, he said, I thought I would feel bad. I'm almost sorry to say I don't. I thought I would at least puke afterwards or something. I just felt nothing. It was kind of cool because it was different. I'll be perfectly honest. I wanted to kill someone for a long time. He also went on to say how controlled he was whilst carrying out the attack. He spoke about attacking Jamie and said he was kind of surprised she's alive. He said he wished that she kind of just died for her sake, just because she's now going to have to live with all of that. It's so ironic when these perpetrators seem to have that mindset. Oh, you know what? I wish Jamie had died like her mother so she didn't have to cope with the trauma of the fact that we killed her mother. It's such a topsy-turvy belief system. Jamie has lost horribly. Jamie has been damaged horribly, but Jamie is loved fully. Jamie has a father who adores her. Jamie will get married and have children and have a successful life in spite of the trauma, but for his own benefit, he would rather she just died so he didn't have to conceive of her living and apparently having to cope with the trauma that they presented. He also said that once the lights had been turned on, it gave him an opportunity to see the extent and horror that they caused. He said, the only thought that really entered my mind at that point was, wow, this looks like a CSI scene. Yes, you absolute dweeb, because it is a CSI scene. It's a crime scene. And of course, there's going to be an investigation because you have killed a woman and tried to kill a child. Also in his testimony, he talked about how chaotic Spader was in the way that he was acting during the killing. So he said that he was hacking at the bed, whereas Gribble said that he knew where, how, and what angle he was going to use, and he was methodical when he was stabbing his victims. So essentially, he's saying that he's proud of how he carried out the killing. He said that Spader enjoyed the butchery part of it, just the power. And he said, I'm more of a precision sort of guy. That's why I aim for specific places. Now, that demonstrates the level of evil running through Gribble's veins because he's genuinely proud of what he was doing. He likes the precision. He likes to get it right when he kills. And I'm sure that there is a level within him that feels he failed because Jamie survived. Now, when it came down to them talking about Gribble's personality, one of the person who gave testimony was Savoy, Autumn Savoy, the one who was obviously charged for helping them cover up the crime. He said that one of the things about Gribble was that he didn't know how to react around people. Gribble's father also said that his son was one of those people who would just believe his own opinion was the right one. In fact, he said he was correct, and that was that. Then they brought witnesses in who talked about Tamara and Richard, who were Gribble's parents, and said that it's just so bizarre to them that this has happened. When you look at their parenting, they were really positive. Richard was described as a really good role model. And someone who actually knew Christopher Gribble said that when they looked outside in at the family, they felt that these were good parents with a really obnoxious teenager who they were incredibly patient with. So essentially, this story of him being abused and having excuses for his actions just did not add up whatsoever. Now, David Cates was given an opportunity to read a victim impact statement, and in that, he said, I've lived the accounts of Kim's murder, one excruciating blow after another. Through these accounts, I've heard my wife's last breath, heard my daughter's screams, seen my daughter's perfect body mutilated. Jamie and I won't live a day without thinking of the horrific things that happened in our home and that Kim will never again be with us. He made the heartbreaking point that his wife would not have known whether her only child was dead or alive as she lay dying. I fully believe, though, that Kim will now know that her daughter is alive, and I do fully believe that they will be reunited one day. In March 2011, Gribble was understandably and immediately found guilty. It didn't wash that he was insane at all. He got sentenced to life in prison without parole. Judge Abramson said that it was her belief that infinity was not enough jail time for him. I love Judge Abramson. Can we bring Judge Abramson in to a lot of the cases I cover, even in the UK? Let's just bring Judge Abramson over. Let's just give some of those sentences out here, because boy, do some people deserve it. Then we get to the sentencing of the other two, who obviously took plea deals. So in April 2011, Marks was sentenced to 30 to 60 years. He had blindsidingly written a poem, which was discovered in his room in prison, which spoke about liking to chop up women, with one part reading, "I always have an axe by my side looking for my next homicide." It's just so breathtakingly evil to write things like that in light of what I'm discussing today. He also admitted to speaking to his dad about trying to sell his story. Why don't we make some cash, eh? Now, Judge Abramson initially rejected his plea deal, and the only reason it was accepted was under the condition that he would never make a profit from his involvement in the crime, so no ill-gotten gains from a horrible, brutal murder. She presided over the trials of Spader and Gribble, so she also understood, as she put it, why the state had needed to make a deal with the devil. So she understood that Marks was going to get off lighter than she believes he deserved, but that was to bring down the other two in this case. And when she actually sentenced Mark, she didn't mince her words. She said that just because he testified against his co-defendants, and we call that cooperation, doesn't mean that there is any redemption for him. Glover, the final one, he was sentenced to 20 to 40 years. He was actually said to be the least involved in the crime out of the four. He couldn't bear to watch or hear as the attack was carried out. Also, he was the only one of the four to actually offer an apology to Kate's family in court. He said, "Every morsel of food that I eat, every breath of air that I take, every beat of my heart, I think of what we have done. I know there is nothing that I can do that will ever atone for my terrible actions and for my failing to do anything. But I promise with all my life that I will try." Now, of course, there is one more involved in this case, which is Autumn Savoy. He wasn't involved in the killing, but he did obviously cover for these guys. So in May 2011, he pleaded guilty to two counts of hindering apprehension and one count of conspiracy to hindering apprehension. He said he didn't know what to do. He just did what he was told. He said that Spader was almost like his brother, so he felt this loyalty towards him. And after Spader had told him what they'd done, he said, "If you tell anyone, I'll fucking kill you." And he probably thought, well, Spader's killed somebody, maybe he will. Now, he was actually sentenced from 5 to 12 years. He again apologised to the Kate's family. He said, "When I was given the opportunity to do the right thing, I made the conscious choice not to. I am truly sorry." He was actually paroled for the first sentence in 2012 and for the others in May 2015. At his hearing, he actually said that he realised that his problems were due to drugs and asked his parole conditions to include an evaluation as to whether he required drug abuse counselling, though at this point he no longer used drugs. But I assume that he may have thought, if I get out, I may go down the wrong path again. Now, in 2013, Spader, interestingly, was given a second sentencing hearing. Now, the reason for this was there'd been a ruling that had been made that determined that minors being sentenced to life in prison without opportunity for parole was unconstitutional. Spader said he didn't want his sentence to be reduced, so he didn't even attend his own hearing. He said he doesn't deserve forgiveness. He said that he was the most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet, and that he chooses to accept responsibility for his actions and not to slip by on some technicality. So in a statement which was read at his rehearing, he wrote, "Through my impulsive actions, I have harmed numerous individuals, both physically and mentally. I have torn apart families and I've ruined lives. But still, I must beg for forgiveness from everyone I've harmed. To the Kate's family, I know my words hold no meaning, but I am truly sorry for the pain that I've caused you. I will be clear, David Cates, who got this and heard this during the hearing, said he found it disingenuous and he found it very insulting. He said Spader had literally only recently said that he felt no remorse for what he'd done. He said that his remorse was weak, if any, and unnecessary. Jeffrey Streslin, who prosecuted, he referred to Spader as a psychopath and said there is no way he's going to grow out of his problems and that it wasn't just a phase to him. Spader was then resentenced to life plus 76 years, so his life sentence was indeed upheld. I actually think that Spader knew that that would be the case. I think that he just created that letter to try to make him look reprehensible. We know that killers often like to minimize, and that was just a way of playing everybody. Oh, I'm not really a bad guy, but I don't really want my sentence reduced, because he was never going to get his sentence reduced. What he did was so brutal, there was very, very low likelihood they would have reduced it to anything significant. Even if they'd taken the 76 years off, he was still going to die in prison. Now, in 2017, Glover was actually paroled for the robbery conviction. He will be eligible for full parole and potential release from prison for the other crimes in 2029. Now, legacy is powerful. And also, even though it doesn't bring back the person who was lost, I think it shows a determination and courage of the family that is immeasurable. They created the Kim Cates Memorial Scholarship, and it's to literally support young people who want to study medicine. And every year on October the 4th, David organises a golf tournament, which is held in his wife's name to raise money for the scholarship fund. He said, Kim's incredible spirit is very much alive, inspiring compassion in others. So whilst Kim's presence is no longer here, her presence is certainly felt in so many directions, including changing other young people's lives by helping them with scholarships for medicine. And I imagine that medicine is so powerfully important, not just because she died. I imagine it would also be to do with the fact that Jamie survived, and that was down to the incredible medics and nurses who will have nursed her back to health. So this is their family's way of saying thank you, and also holding a legacy of huge importance for Kim, who was an incredible human being, and also for the impact that Kim's loss has in building other people's lives with these scholarships. It, like I said at the very beginning, breaks my heart, this case, because I want to believe that when I go to bed at night, I am safe. And yet this tells that story that all it takes is for random individuals who have no relationship with us to make a conscious decision to make our lives unsafe that results in a case as I'm speaking about today. Kim should have gone to sleep with her daughter in that bed of bonding, feeling absolutely entitled to her security, and yet it was broken to smithereens by the selfishness, egocentricity, and murderous intent of these young men. I hope that those with their conscience being pricked on a daily basis really do hold their actions deep within their psyche, that it impacts and infects every moment of their being forever. And for the men who do not feel that way, those who are locked up for the rest of their natural life, they are in the right place, because it is possible that some people can never change. And when it comes down to Spader and Gribble, I fully believe that to be the case. They were not insane. They were simply individuals who were a folie à deux and believed that they had a right to take lives. And now the state has taken theirs. They will never be free. They will live their lives inside amongst dangerous other individuals, and they will never know what it is truly like to know potential, to know future, to know hope, because it's gone. That is the amazing thing about this judge in this case, that she took no prisoners and instead made sure that there are two who are prisoners for life. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.